This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Don Hewitt, the veteran TV producer-director who created the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes, died this week at the age of 86. In a few minutes, we'll listen to Terry's 2001 interview with Hewitt. But first, our TV critic David Biancooley, who considers Hewitt one of the seminal figures in the history of television news.
Don Hewitt didn't invent the TV news magazine, but he sure invented the most successful and durable one. He created 60 Minutes in 1968, 41 years ago. And like the signature stopwatch that has opened every hour since the beginning, it's still ticking. In fact, this Sunday's 60 Minutes will be devoted entirely to Don Hewitt. And the problem won't be filling the hour, but narrowing it down to one. On camera, there are two figures in TV news who rise above all others, Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. Murrow invented and set the standards for television news at CBS, and Cronkite exemplified them in the 1960s and beyond. Off camera, Don Hewitt worked with them both. Not only worked with them, but predated them and outlasted them. His career, like his impact on television news, is unparalleled. Start with 60 Minutes, his most enduring legacy. The show has ranked in TV's top 10 in several different decades and has ranked a handful of times as television's most popular show. No other news magazine has achieved a number one ranking for the season even once. And the show's popularity, while definitely skewing older in audience appeal, isn't in the past. Last week's installment, featuring the first post-prison TV interview with Michael Vick, was the week's second most popular program. That's an amazing track record for a show that premiered in 1968. But Don Hewitt, who created 60 Minutes, has a track record that is even more amazing. It took 10 years for 60 Minutes to finish in TV's top 10. And by the time it did, Don Hewitt already had been at CBS News for 30 years. And he'd stay there for another 25 years until he retired from 60 Minutes in 2003. Don Hewitt is like the Forrest Gump or the Zelig of TV news. Whenever something important happened, no matter what year, Hewitt was likely to be there. When CBS began presenting a nightly newscast in 1948 with Douglas Edwards as the anchor, Don Hewitt was an associate director and soon became the program's director. And when Edward R. Murrow made a wary but brilliant transition from radio to television in 1951's landmark CBS news magazine See It Now, Don Hewitt was at his side, literally, as Murrow explained at the start of the very first show.
This is an old team trying to learn a new trade. When we started this series of programs, we had to decide where to do it from. We decided to do it right here from the studio. My purpose will be not to get in your light any more than I can, to lean over the cameraman's shoulder occasionally and say a word which may help to illuminate or explain what is happening. We have here two monitors, which will serve in effect the purpose of loudspeakers. They are tied, so to speak, to lines that come in from Chicago, New York, Washington, various other places. We will, from time to time, show film on those monitors as well. We are, as newcomers to this medium, rather impressed by the whole thing. Impressed, for example, that I can turn to Don Hewitt here and say, Don, will you push a button and bring in the Atlantic Coast?
And at that point, Don Hewitt was just getting started. In 1952, he directed TV coverage of the national political conventions. In 1956, when the luxury liner the Andrea Doria sank at sea and CBS dispatched a helicopter to film the only TV footage of its sinking, Don Hewitt was manning the camera. In 1960, Hewitt was the director for the unprecedented and politically crucial televised presidential campaign debates between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy. In 1963, when Kennedy was assassinated, Hewitt directed the massive nonstop days of coverage for CBS, the coverage that made Walter Cronkite a TV icon. And so on, up to and including Bill and Hillary Clinton's campaign-saving 1992 appearance on 60 Minutes. Arguably, Don Hewitt influenced the elections of JFK in 1960 and Bill Clinton 32 years later. And Hewitt's career didn't end there. But it's not just the durability or the impact that impresses me, though both of those do impress me. More than anything else, what's most incredible about Don Hewitt's accomplishments is the quality. Almost everything he directed, everything he touched, was impressive and presented with a clear respect for the audience. When Walter Cronkite died earlier this summer, Many expressed regret that we'll never see his kind again in TV news. Sad to say, but the same thing is true of Don Hewitt.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University. Terry Gross spoke to Don Hewitt in 2001 when his memoir called Tell Me a Story was published. They talked about some of his earlier days in television, including his work producing and directing the Nixon-Kennedy debates in 1960. The conventional wisdom is that Nixon fared poorly not because of what he said, but how he looked on television. Terry asked Don Hewitt how Nixon ended up looking the way he did.
Well, first of all, Kennedy took it very seriously. Jack Kennedy and I had a meeting in a hangar in Chicago a week before the debate. He stopped there on a campaign trip, and I briefed him on all the things that we expected of him and what we were going to do and what we wanted him to do. I never saw Nixon until he walked in the studio that night, and he did not take it as seriously as Kennedy did. He spent that afternoon speaking to the Plumbers Union. Kennedy rested up for the debate. Nixon thought it was just another campaign appearance, had no idea what a splash it was going to make in America. He was ill. He'd had a staphylococcus infection. He arrived at the studio at WBBM in Chicago, smacked his knee on the door of the car as he was getting out, was in pain. But what I remember most about that night was over and above the fact, well, first of all, I brought a makeup person from New York. He needed it. Kennedy didn't. I said to the both of them, do you want to be made up? Kennedy said no. Nixon heard him say no and figured, if I get made up, everybody the next day will say, well, Nixon was wearing makeup and Kennedy wasn't. So he refused it, but had some of his own guys smear him with something called shave stick, and he looked like the wrath of God. He really looked terrible.
What was shave stick?
It's some dopey thing that guys use to cover their beard. If you're going out for the night, in the old days before there were electric razors, I mean, what you did is you smeared some of this stuff on and it covered the beard. He looked awful. Now, the day after Kennedy was assassinated, we did a special broadcast in New York, and Nixon was on it. And the same makeup person whose services he had refused in Chicago was making him up. And I said to him, you know, Mr. Nixon, if Franny here had made you up at the first debate, you'd have been president now. Without a beat. I mean, it happened so fast it stunned me. He whirled around and he said to me, yeah, I would have been dead now, too. I mean, it was eerie. It was strange. He really believed that whoever killed Jack Kennedy, and I'm not going to say it was Lee Harvey Oswald because I'm not even sure it was, whoever killed Jack Kennedy, he wanted to convince me was out to get a president, not that president. And it was a strange, strange conversation.
Let me get to the Kennedy assassination. In your book, you say that after Kennedy was assassinated and you found out about the Zapruder film, you told Dan Rather to go to Zapruder's house, punch him in the nose, get the film, bring it to CBS, make a copy, then return it to Zapruder. What were you thinking?
I was one of these, you know, Hildy Johnson, hell for leather. It was stupid. I did things in the early days that if someone who worked for me did them today, I'd fire them. I said, we got to get a hold of the Zapruder film. Maybe it's public domain, but we'll never find out unless we get it. I would like to see it. So I said, Dan, hit him, grab the film, take it to the studio, we'll copy it, then let the CBS lawyers decide what to do with it. Meanwhile, return the film. All they can get you for is an assault. You've returned his stolen property. And he said, great, I'll do it. And then all of a sudden, I thought to myself, are you crazy? Why did you do that? And I thank God when I called him back, he hadn't left yet. And I said, Dan, don't do that. That's stupid. I think the whole day got to me. And I, you know, we were all kind of limp the end of that day.
But I think this says something about you, which is that you really have that competitive thing real strong.
Yeah, really. I guess I am a strong competitor, and sometimes this competitive zeal causes you to do things that you're, when you look back on them, you're kind of ashamed that you even thought of them.
Great. How about another example?
Oh my God! Once an airplane went down in the East River off LaGuardia Airport in New York, and there was one tugboat out on the river that you could go out on and go to the wreck because there was a tugboat strike. But this boat had come from New Haven. And I went down with everybody else, and all the television crews were there, and the captain was telling this story of the what it was like out on the river and the floating wreckage and the bodies, and he was going on. And I don't know why, but I kind of said, well, who owns this boat? And he said, New Haven Tugboat Company. And all the reporters turned to me like, what are you, crazy? Who cares who owns the boat? This guy's telling us a great story, and you ask a stupid question. And they said, Captain, go on, please go on with your story, and Hewitt, will you shut up with your dumb questions? And as they said that, I sneaked out of the door, went down to the dock, called the CBS newsroom and said, call the New Haven Tugboat Company and charter their boat. So I got back, all the guys saw me come back, and they were all kind of going, don't ask any dumb questions. And at this point, the phone rings, the captain goes to the phone, he says, yes, sir, and then he looks around, he says, who's Hewitt? I said, I am. He said, well, the boat's now under charter to you. What do you want to do? I said, well, first thing I want to do is throw all these guys off my boat. So I was very competitive. And in fact, the only way the Today Show could get any pictures of the wreck was to come out on a rowboat with an outboard motor in the morning. And by mistake, we rammed them. I mean, we really didn't mean to hit them, but we did. And next thing I know, I come back and I get hell because there was a formal complaint from NBC to CBS that I tried to sink their boat in the East River, and all I could think to say was, cry babies.
Now, you say when you started 60 Minutes, you also wanted to create a more personal form of journalism. You write, the documentaries on TV all seem to be the voice of the corporation. What do you mean by that? And what do you mean by a more personal form? Yeah.
Okay. Editorials were the voice of the newspaper, which nobody really cared about. They cared about columnists. And documentaries were sort of the voice of the corporation, you know, NBC White Paper, CBS Reports, ABC Close Up. And I said, there's nothing personal. And I wanted personal journalism. I don't mean advocacy journalism. I don't think I wanted to advocate anything. I wanted to take people along on the story. And a lot of it came out of a broadcast that was very popular in CBS in the early days. Actually, it wasn't on CBS. I think it was on NBC, called Four Star Theater, in which Dick Powell, Charles Boyer, Ida Lupino, and David Niven had a repertory company, which each week, all they played different parts, and there was no star. There were just four great actors playing parts. And I said, wow, I'd like to do a repertory company of reporters. I don't want any stars. I don't want an Ed Sullivan out front introducing the acts. I want them to be my version of a repertory company, only these are reporters, not actors. And it caught on. People essentially bought that television set to be entertained. They didn't buy the set to be informed. And I said, if you can entertain them while you're informing them, you're ahead of the game. And it was a concept that caught on.
CBS producer Don Hewitt speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 2001 interview with TV producer and director Don Hewitt, who died this week at the age of 86. Hewitt created the CBS news magazine 60 Minutes.
You always hear rumors about shows. The rumor that I've heard about 60 Minutes, and you can tell me if this is true, is that sometimes the producer of a segment actually does the interview, and then the reporter comes in and is filmed asking those questions, even though they didn't really ask those questions to the person
never,
being interviewed.
Never. Never. Never, ever happened.
Have you ever heard that one?
Oh, yeah, hear everything. Listen, Hillary Clinton, for Christ's sake, after we did the famous Jennifer Flowers thing, She told the Associated Press that we changed all the questions between the time they did it and the time we put on the air. And I called her up and I said, you got to realize she was just another woman, wife of a candidate. And I said, that's libelous. That's defamatory. And she said, well, it appeared to me to be that way. And I figured, sure, it appeared to be that way. She was shell-shocked. I mean, she couldn't believe what, you know, they had to sit there and defend that night. So that has never, ever happened. Nobody has ever changed a question or had a producer ask a question and then later filmed a correspondent asking it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Clintons interview. How did the Clintons end up on 60 Minutes that night? And what were they expecting? What did they think was in it for them?
What did they think? Oh, my God. They were in trouble. He was about to disappear into the snow in New Hampshire. And they called up and they said they wanted to go on the air and set the record straight about Jennifer Flowers. And for all the time we taped, all they did was set the record crooked. They never set the record straight. And do you know that the right wing, the so-called right wing, because I don't believe in right wing, left wing, but the so-called right wing holds me responsible for his getting the nomination, which he did after that show. Do you know that I'm persona non grata in the Clinton, I was in the Clinton White House? I've been invited to every White House going back to Harry Truman. I was persona non grata with the Clintons. What there was about that, I guess they didn't want to think about that night. But we didn't do anything but give them a chance to answer the questions, and they sat there and fudged everything.
What do you consider the lies that they told that you were referring to?
The lies? I mean, that never was a Jennifer Flowers and it never happened? Later on, he admitted it.
So if the Clintons came on because they wanted to talk about Jennifer Flowers and deny that there was any mm-hmm. truth to that story, what mm-hmm. so upset them about the interview?
I don't know. They claim that I said we would also give you a chance to talk about your vision of America. And I said, no. We thought we were going to do a long piece, and they gave me 9 minutes that night for the whole show because it was after the Super Bowl. And I said, there's no time to do anything but this one story. And if you want to give your vision of America, I'm sure they'll sell you commercial time to do it. But after all, you got to realize at the time, Terry, he was one of five guys trying to get the nomination. He wasn't even the front runner. He was just another candidate trying to get the Democratic nomination.
Let me ask you about one of the many 60 Minutes stories that became very controversial, and this one particularly controversial because a movie was made about it, The Insider. Mm-hmm. You know, this mm-hmm. is the case of Jeffrey Wigand, the former vice mm-hmm. president for research and development at Brown & Williamson Tobacco,
right.
who mm-hmm. blew the whistle on how the company had adjusted right. the levels of nicotine, keeping smokers addicted. And the story was killed at 60 Minutes because of corporate fear of a lawsuit. What kind of lawsuit?
No, it was not killed at 60 Minutes because of corporate fear of a lawsuit. It was killed by the corporation before we ever got a chance to put on the air. But we did go on the air and tell everything we learned from Wigand without using his name. So it's not true that we ran away from that story.
And the way...
The company didn't want us to use his name because they feared a lawsuit. And we actually went on the air, and Mike Wallace actually did something that no news organization has ever done before. He told the audience that we were prohibited from using Wigand's name because CBS had turned chicken and was afraid of a lawsuit, which wasn't even threatened. It was just the perception that it might be.
Was this a very frustrating experience for you watching the movie?
Let me tell you, the God's honest truth.
Yeah.
They'd gotten Paul Newman or Robert Redford to play me, I'd have forgiven them anything.
Yeah, but who did play you?
Some guy named...
Philip Baker Hall.
Philip Baker Hall. I said, that's not a guy. That's a dormitory.
Yeah, but you ought to retract that statement. He's a great actor. He's fantastic. Did you ever
to
see...
To you, he may be.
Yeah,
to
no,
me,
did you ever
dormitory.
See Magnolia or Hard Eight? Or...
Yeah, I saw The Insider, and Okay, I said if Paul Newman or Robert Redford had played me, I'd have forgiven him anything.
Well, Philip Baker Hall can play me anytime.
Good. I hope he doesn't for your sake.
Don Hewitt speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2001. Hewitt died this week. He was 86. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest, James Bobin, has been nominated for an Emmy for directing the HBO comedy series Flight of the Conchords, about a band of the same name. Its second season has just come out on DVD. Bobin is also the co-creator and co-writer of the series. He helped the Conchords, Jemaine Clement and Brett McKenzie, build a TV show around their catchy song parodies, like this one.
With a girl, I'm serious.
Ooh, that's great news, Brett. Tell me about that girl that's so serious.
Well, I don't really know her.
Ooh, that don't sound so serious.
We're serious, I'm delirious.
Sound serious?
Yeah.
That's cool. I met a new girl, too.
Have you?
Yeah.
One of those girls you met on the net.
No, we really met.
Well, that's great news. What's she like? What does she do?
All I know, dog, is that she's careless with her dog. I'm not sure what she does, except she makes me want her. She makes me want to get on top of her.
Oh, that sounds great, man. That sounds great. Hey, wait.
What?
Maybe I'm crazy, but when'd you meet this lady?
Just then.
When?
Then.
Right then.
Right then.
Where?
There.
Over there.
Over there.
Over there, there.
Over there, there, there.
Down.
How'd you meet your lady?
I was going for a jog and she lost the dog.
I was running in the air and she lost the terrier.
Was this about 40 seconds ago?
No, about 43 seconds ago.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
No, no, what?
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
No, I'm thinking what I'm thinking.
So you're not thinking what I'm thinking?
No, because you're thinking I'm thinking what you're thinking.
Are you talking about a girl with a beautiful smile?
Yeah.
Like strawberry wine.
Yeah, yeah.
And blueberry tracksuit pants.
White chocolate skin.
And socks.
That sounds like her.
Hang on a minute. Stop the track. Eugene, stop the track. Do you mean the girl who came up to us when we were running in the park just now? And she was looking for her epileptic dog.
Yeah, that's the girl.
What's her name, Barbara?
No, I think it was Barbara.
Her name was Barbara.
It was Barbara. There's no such name as Barbara.
It's Barbara.
It's Barbara.
It was Barbara.
Barbara.
Barbara. Barbara.
The Flight of the Conchords centers on these two awkward musicians who came to New York from their native New Zealand to try and make it in the music business. The show draws on the real experiences of Clement and McKenzie and incorporates their songs, which parody soul, pop, and hip-hop. Before working on Flight of the Conchords, Bobin helped Sacha Baron Cohen create the characters of Ali G, Borat, and Bruno for The Ali G Show. Terry spoke with James Bobin earlier this year. In this scene from the second season of The Flight of the Conchords, Brett and Jemaine are really down on their luck. Their manager, Murray, has another act that's made it big called The Crazy Dogs. Brett and Jemaine are tired of being ignored, so during a meeting with Murray, they decide to end their relationship with him. Murray is played by Rhys Darby.
Dear Murray, we want to fire you as our manager.
What?
What?
What's your reasoning, Brett?
You spend all your time on the Crazy Dogs and you don't really spend any time on us.
Before you came to me, you were poor and you had no gigs. Now look at you.
We're poor and we've got no gigs.
We're slightly poorer.
Are you really?
Yeah, Brett's only got one shoe.
Oh, Brett. Is that what this is about?
Well,
one shoe.
It's not,
no,
it's not about
shoe.
The shoe. I just lost my shoe.
Not a problem. What size are you?
Size 9.
Get you another shoe.
It's not about the shoe. It's about...
Your right foot. Yeah, hi, Murray here. I need a right foot shoe.
Murray, we're firing you. We're going to manage ourselves.
Right, I understand it. Okay, fine. You know what? Actually, there's another item here on the agenda I missed out. Oh, yes, here it is. Item 4. Stuff you.
Sure that's not for the Crazy Dogs?
Stuff you, Jemaine, and stuff you, Brett. And stuff you again, Jemaine.
Why did I get double stuffed?
I don't need you guys. You're unneeded, okay? I've got the Crazy Dogs. They're making hit after hit. Doggy Bounce, number 1. Doggy Dance, number 5. In the Pound, number 37. It's not going to stop. It's never going to stop. They're a hit-making machine. Look at their gold records. And just to let you know, your awards over there, they're fake. I had to make them myself.
What?
They're pencil sharpeners stuck to a couple of bits of wood to make you feel better.
We didn't win the Grammys.
No, you didn't.
I thought we won Best New Zealand Artist.
There's no such category, Jemaine.
James Bobin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
So that was from the first episode of this season of Flight of the Conchords. So Murray's success, we should point out, is very short-lived.
Yes, of course, of course. Yes, the Crazy Dogs come to a sticky end.
So I love Flight of the Conchords. So you met Brett and Germaine at the Edinburgh Festival back in 2000. And I think then you were asked eventually by HBO to start a series with them.
That's right.
What was the initial process like of working out what the show would actually be?
Well, I actually first saw Brett and Germaine at the Edinburgh Festival in a small cave. Edinburgh is a city which in August every year hosts literally thousands of comedy shows. And so every venue which is would possibly be a venue, from pub back rooms to cellars, become venues. And I'd heard of this band from New Zealand. I went up in week two. It's a four-week festival. And by the time I arrived in week two, there's quite a lot of people talking about these two guys from New Zealand who sang comedy songs. When I got there, the room was absolutely jam-packed. You know, the seats about 50 with 100 people in there. And these two sort of vaguely nervous, bumbling guys stumbled onto stage. And they were sort of immediately quite charming because you felt, I don't know, sympathy, empathy with them in their situation. They didn't seem that confident in their performance. But then they proceeded to do one of the best comedy hours I've ever seen, whereby they not only had sort of 10 to 12 brilliant songs, but the banter in between the songs was fantastic. I mean, hilarious. And the key for me was that I wanted to make the live show quite an important part of the TV show. So in a very direct translation, you'd take their live songs and create music videos of those, and take the banter between Brett and Germaine on stage and create a narrative from that banter. But it was fairly clear from a very early stage that we all shared a similar idea of what the show could be. And we sort of all just sat around and imagined how that might be, and we're all a bit nervous about the fact that musicals often don't work. And I very clearly remember going down, when we were sort of developing the idea, going to the Museum of Television History in Beverly Hills and calling up all the existing copies of Stephen Botchko's show Cop Rock. And the three of us sat there around a monitor watching this show, which I think is either the most ahead of its time show ever, or I just can't imagine how it ever came to pass. But it was really quite an interesting watch in terms of how people approach music in TV.
One of the great things about Flight of the Conchords is that there's all these wonderful parodies of rock videos.
Sure.
And in episode two of this season, when the band is really completely broke, their electricity's been turned off, Britt's had to hawk his guitar.
Yes.
So they decide that Germaine's going to become a prostitute and Britt will be his pimp.
Naturally. Yes. Of course. What else are you going to do in that situation?
And of course, they completely misinterpret like how prostitution works. And there's
yes, they have a very innocent idea of what prostitution actually is.
Yeah, why don't you explain?
Largely divine from the film Pretty Woman. Right. Wrong way around.
So here's that scene you're talking about in which Germaine is trying to convince Britt that they can become prostitutes.
Britt, you know how you told me you were good at sex? Are you?
No, that was just because you asked me in front of Sally.
Right, yeah. Okay. Well, you're lying then.
Nah, I was exaggerating a little bit. Nah, exaggerating.
Well, maybe Mel's right. Maybe we could be prostitutes. Prostitution is a quick way of making money. It is not degrading. It is not degrading. Have you seen Pretty Woman?
No.
Well, it's the story about a prostitute called Richard Gere, who gets to go out with a pretty woman, Julia Roberts, who pays him a lot of money. You think Julia Roberts is a pretty woman?
Yes.
Well, imagine getting to have sex with women similar to Julia Roberts and getting paid for it.
That's a scene from episode two of this season's Flight of the Conchords. My guest, James Bobin, directed that episode. He's a writer and director on the series and also co-created it. So there's a great scene in which Britt is singing what's really a parody of the Sting song Roxanne. And
yes.
In Roxanne, the lyric is, "Roxanne, you don't have to put on your red light." And mm-hmm. in... in this, it's like, "Germaine, you don't have to be a prostitute." So I thought,
yes, you spotted it. Well done.
Yeah. So go ahead.
It was an idea that Germaine had a while ago. I think it's one of those songs which, for us, it was a funny idea in the first place that anyone would ever sing a song about someone being a prostitute. The idea that you could somehow stop them from being a prostitute by singing to them was to us an hilarious idea. And Germaine had an idea a while ago. There's actually a song called Maxine, which is by a New Zealand artist, which is literally was released probably 2 years after the Police song Roxanne, and is remarkably similar in many ways. And that was also an inspiration to us in terms of the idea that you could actually somehow solve prostitution revolution by singing about it. So from a very early point, we thought that was quite a funny idea. And then, of course, it sort of fitted into our narrative that we like the idea that Brett and Jermaine are poor because that's what happens when you first move to a foreign country. You are poor. And you don't see very much of that on television. So it's quite important for us to sort of let that part of the story play.
Well, why don't we hear the song?
A man whose pants are too tight. Oh no, his pants are too tight.
My pants are too tight.
He stands there, an empty stare, trying to make enough money for his cab fare home. He'll have to walk home tonight.
Don't have enough for the ride.
The streets are cruel, he tries to act cool. He goes to work with only his one tool. You can put away your tool, Jermaine. You don't have to be a prostitute. No, 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 no. You can say no to being a man whore, a male gigolo. You don't have to be a prostitute. No, 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 no. You can say no to being a night looker boy, hooker, red boy, bro.
So that's Brett McKenzie singing to Jermaine Clement, "You Don't Have to Be a Prostitute," from episode 2 of this season's HBO series, Flight of the Conchords. My guest, James Bobin, is one of the writers and directors of the series, and he directed this episode. It must be so much fun to direct parodies of rock videos. Have you found yourself going back to a lot of classic rock videos to get little details that you could pay homage to?
We try not to directly parody them or spoof them too much, because I think, I genuinely believe there's a great grammar of music video. Music video has been around for such a long time, ever since Bohemian Rhapsody in the 1970s, that I think the certain ways videos were shot instantly mean that you recognise the various cues that directors and DPs use at that time. For example, if you shoot an 80s video, it's all about backlight and ground fog and, you know, it's that sort of stuff. So I think that there's a grammar to music videos that people will recognise if you shoot them that way. They'll say, oh, that's like an 80s video, that's a 90s video. And I use a lot of that sort of thing.
Right, right. So you go back and you study these videos and get inspiration. So do you just spend a lot of time looking for videos,
yeah,
just getting ideas?
When we're supposed to be writing the shows, which is for quite a long time, we spend far too much of our time on YouTube watching old videos because they are so inspirational and so fantastic, for both music and for visuals. Because, of course, I think there was a great heyday of videos, I think, in the 80s when the budgets were enormous, and so they went completely over the top, and they are, as a consequence, hilarious to watch just on their own. I mean, they're just a gift to us because they're so fantastic. And also, they're interesting. I've always loved music. My father was a DJ at Radio Oxford in the 60s, and I always remember when I was about 10, he gave me a huge box of 45s of 60s and 70s music, so I know far, far too much about music that was made before I was born. But from an early age, I've always loved music, and I think music videos became very much almost half the... You know, music videos were an integral part of music in the 80s and 90s. And not so much these days, sadly, but I think in those days it was a really important aspect of the single release was the video. The video was a very important selling tool.
So what was in that box of 45s that your father gave you?
My goodness, just extraordinary stuff. Obviously, lots of Beatles stuff, but even bizarre things. I mean, just weird late 60s, early 70s, a lot of T-Rex. I remember having a T-Rex single. I think Get It On was the A-side. And obscure bands like Atomic Rooster and Canned Heat, which obviously are fantastic. And so I think as a 7-year-old, I had a very strange taste in music. When my friends were listening to Adam and the Ants and Wham, I was listening to Canned Heat and sort of straight, you know, and Roxy music.
James Bobin is director and co-creator of the HBO series Flight of the Conchords. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview with James Bobin, director and co-creator of the HBO series Flight of the Conchords.
So in Flight of the Conchords, Rhys Darby plays the Conchords agent, Murray, who mm-hmm. works at the New Zealand consulate.
He does. He's,
but he really wants to be a rock star manager, although his only clients are the Conchords. In episode 1 of this season, after the Conchords fire Murray as their manager, he gets to sing a very operatic song called Rejected. And it seems like it's a parody of an Andrew Lloyd Webber song from a show that I stayed away from. I have no idea if it's a direct parody of a particular song or not.
It's not really a direct parody. It is certainly Andrew Lloyd Webber-esque. Last year, we sang a song called Leggy Blonde, which I thought was a highlight for me of the last season. And this year, I wanted to start the show with a surprise. So it Rejected sort of came out of that idea, whereby there'd be a song straight away and it wouldn't be sung by Brett and Jermaine. And the style of it was partly just because the melodrama of the situation. We loved the idea that Reese would take the firing of being fired very personally and see it as a sort of great tragedy. And I thought one of the great purveyors of this sort of melodrama these days is Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. And so that was sort of the inspiration behind that one. Then it was just a question of finding words which ended in ED.
Yeah, I don't think there's one word in the dictionary that rhymes with rejected that you haven't used in this song.
No, it's pretty much the entire. Yes, exactly, yes.
Why don't we hear some of it? So this is the character of Murray, who's played by Rhys Darby, singing Rejected in Flight of the Conchords.
Rejected, thrown away, affected, I don't know what to say. Ejected, cast out to the sea, disconnected, they didn't want me.
Unprotected, like a baby in the snow. Dejected, like a clown without a show. I objected, pretended I was unaffected, but still ended up rejected, like a cake show.
That's Rhys Darby as Murray, the manager in Flight of the Conchords, singing Rejected. My guest, James Bobin, is the co-creator of the show. He wrote the episode that this is from and is also a director on the series. Is that Rhys Darby's real voice? Does he have that operatic voice?
I'd rather not say, to be honest. No, it's not Rhys.
I would take that as a no.
No, it's a no. It's a no. Okay. Rhys has got a pretty good voice, but not that good. That is one of the leading tenors in New York who supplied the voice there. But yes, it's not his real voice.
In Flight of the Conchords, Kristen Schaal plays Mel, who's the fan base. She's like the only fan of the band, and she's kind of wacky. She's really fun in it. And, you know, in the series Mad Men, she initially played like somebody who was one of the phone operators at the advertising agency, and then she just kind of disappeared from the series. Then she was on The Daily Show for at least a couple of episodes. Were you in on casting her for the series?
Yes, very much. Yes, no, I chose her because we were aware of her work from Aspen, the comedy festival over in Aspen. We were big fans. And actually, I actually cast her from a tape. I never met her. I watched a tape of her doing her show in Aspen, and it was just a brilliant start. She came out and said, "Hello, I'm a sexy librarian." And I thought, this is exactly the sort of person I want to meet Mel to be, as a sexy librarian. I just like the idea of her being, and also the character, I don't want the character to be too two-dimensional, in the sense that a lot of bands have quite odd fans who are almost obsessive in their following. I wanted to have a grounding, and that's why I gave her a husband and a job. And the husband was very indulgent in her obsession with the Conchords, and I found that an interesting idea, because in the same way that Murray's got a job and is doing something else, therefore is kind of a real character, Mel is helped by the fact that she has a real life outside of the Conchords, and the Conchords are kind of like a strange sort of part of her life, which isn't really representative of the rest of her life. But no, Kristen is a fantastic stand-up. Most of the people on the show are stand-up comedians, and that was something I was very keen to do because I love the idea of them in being able to improvise, because that always helps to the freshness of the show.
Well, James Bobin, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. No, thank you very much.
James Bobin, director, co-creator, and co-writer of the HBO series Flight of the Conchords, speaking with Terry Gross in January. Bobin's been nominated for an Emmy for Best Direction in a Comedy Series for the show. Its second season is now out on DVD. Quentin Tarantino's seventh feature, Inglourious Basterds, sixth if you count both parts of Kill Bill as one movie, borrows and cheekily misspells the title of a 1978 war film. The resemblances end there. The new film stars Brad Pitt as the leader of a vigilante squad, killing Nazis in gory fashion in occupied France. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Quentin Tarantino often caricatures himself. Interviewed in a rollicking documentary about Australian exploitation movies, Not Quite Hollywood, he describes a female revenge flick in which a half-naked woman is tied to the front of a car. If you like outrageous cinema, he babbles, you live and breathe for this. You're going, who the bleep thought of that? That is, of course, the cry he wants to elicit from us watching his films. But if such provocations were his only motive, Tarantino wouldn't be a major director. His World War II revenge fantasia, Inglourious Basterds, set in German-occupied France, is certainly a collection of who the bleep thought of that set pieces, but it's also a switchback journey through his twisted inner landscape, where movies and history, misogyny and feminism, sadism and romanticism collide and create bizarre new hybrids. The movie is an ungainly pastiche. Yet on some whacked-out level, it's organic. The overture is stunning. To the twang of Ennio Morricone spaghetti western music, a French farmer watches a jeep filled with Nazi soldiers travel the long road to his farm. Close-ups of his anxious face alternate with long shots of the car coming nearer in a way that compares to both Hitchcock and Sergio Leone. What follows is an excessively, unnervingly polite interrogation over the farmer's kitchen table by Nazi hunter Hans Landa, played by an elegant and insinuating actor named Christoph Waltz. To watch Landa slowly move in for the kill in a protracted shot of both men is to understand that Tarantino, for all his infamous gore, is at his best in drawn-out dialogues humming with subtext that precede the carnage. Inglourious Basterds has two major strands and many minor ones. The most emotional part of the film centers on Melanie Laurent's Shoshana Dreyfus, a Jew who escaped from that farm and forges a new identity running a Paris cinema. The other half follows the title brigade, the Bastards for short, American Jews led by non-Jew, part Apache Southerner Aldo Rain, played by Brad Pitt, puffing out his jaw to look like Brando. The Bastards are famous for scalping or beating in the brains of Nazis. Sure, it never happened, but watching Pitt's Rain taunt a prostrate commandant, you so wish it had.
I assume you know who we are.
Your elder, the Apache.
But Warren, if you heard of us, you probably heard we ain't in the prisoner-taking business. We in the killing Nazi business. And cousin, businesses are booming.
Oh, yeah.
That leaves two ways we can play this out. Either kill you or let you go. Up the road a piece, there's an orchard. Besides you, we know there's another crop patrol f***ing around here somewhere. If that patrol were to have any crack shots, that orchard would be a goddamn sniper's delight. So if you ever want to eat a sauerkraut sandwich again, you gotta show me on this here map where they are. You gotta tell me how many they are, and you gotta tell me what kind of artillery they're carrying with them.
I won't attempt to diagram the narrative, which is full of digressions that are more fun than the main line, but I'll say that Inglourious Basterds builds to a chaotic climax in a cinema in which Shoshana schemes to blow up top Nazi brass at the premiere of a Goebbels-produced propaganda epic starring a real-life Nazi hero, a blue-eyed young Aryan who happens to be wooing her, unaware she's a Jewess. But I'm afraid on the level of pure staging, Tarantino isn't up to the phantasmagorical climax. It feels choppy and labored, and both the action and Pitt's performance drift into camp. One problem is Inglourious Basterds peaks half an hour earlier in a beer cellar full of Nazis when a British agent and film scholar, played by Michael Fassbender, and two of the Bastards meet with a gorgeous German movie star, played by Diane Kruger, working undercover. The scene goes on and on and on, endlessly digressive, so that you're both laughing and on the brink of screaming with dread. It's that, not the bloody scalpings and splatter, that make you say, who the bleep thought of that? The answer, of course, is someone who believes that myth can trump history, who says no furor can survive the onslaught of a world exploitation cinema auteur.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.